I'll just introduce Mufaro. So Mufaro works at Aligned, which is a startup intent on providing real value-based care solutions for specific complex problems within the healthcare sector, with the goal of creating a more compassionate and sustainable healthcare system. The first of the problems that they are tackling is palliative care in oncology, and it has been in operation since 2021. Mufaro works across various divisions at Aligned, and he carries the title problem solver, so he's the guy to listen to. He was working at Percept, which is a multidisciplinary consultancy with a deep interest in healthcare. He has educational background from UCT in actuarial science and entrepreneurship. I like your talk. It's about how to, and it follows nicely from the presentations that we were having. And we are certainly hoping to get some practical knowledge in terms of aligning incentives and probably having more value-based care in our healthcare system. So, far over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charlton. Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me here at ASA, and thank you for coming back after lunch. This is the last shift, so hopefully the energy levels are still somewhere there, and you can bear with me for what will be 45 minutes, or 40. What does on time count as now that we've started a little bit late? I'll try my best. Thank you for the intro. As he said, my name is Mufaro. Really today I am here to speak on behalf of Aligned, and as Charlton mentioned, we are a startup in the healthcare space, pent on delivering real value-based care. And we've recently finished our first year in operation in 2021, and I would like to share some of the learnings that we've had from our experience in that first year, and hopefully that'll leave you with things that you can take into your worlds to hopefully enable more value-based care. I believe the healthcare actuaries play a key role in redesigning our healthcare system. So some of it may not be directly what you would do as actuaries in the space, but I think the overall content is very much important for this audience. And before I get into it, I just want to give a shout-out to our CEO who's joined me here today, who joined me in the Q&A. If you guys ask me anything too weird, I'm just going to throw it back to her. Cool. So let's begin. So the structure of this talk is I'm going to highlight what we can achieve when we focus on value, and sort of just walk you through some of the outcomes that we've managed to achieve in our first year of operation. And then we're going to break down what value-based care sort of means and how we can enable it, and then speak to contracting and aligning incentives when working with value-based care. And then, of course, just close it off. Cool. So, as I said, a year of operation has really showcased some of the value and showcased what is achievable. And before I show you that, I just want to give a little bit of context to what problem we started with, which is palliative care in oncology. And palliative care is really about providing symptom relief, so not focusing on the illness itself, but support for the patient and the family around the quality of life when dealing with a serious illness. And this was really the perfect place to start. It was quite inviting for value for various reasons, those of which are listed there. So it's very much patient-centered by nature. So all about quality of life. It's interdisciplinary. The training in palliative care invites providers to work together, to work collaboratively. it's highly altruistic, inviting people that typically aren't extremely commercially orientated, which is generally the case in healthcare, but extra in palliative care. And it was and remains disenfranchised. There wasn't a lot of sort of baggage in terms of fee-for-service in that space because there was already sort of a limited funding environment for palliative care. So it was really a great place for us to start. And within palliative care, we actually just focused on oncology, which is a subset of this singular problem. And in 1 year, the results really are quite phenomenal, I think. I'm going to start by maybe just giving a quick context of to, you know, where these results come from. So we've helped about 500 patients since we started, and the first odd about 180 died while with us during 2021. So those 120 patients are the people that we have measured these outcomes against to try and assess what kind of value did we produce for these patients that we were looking after. So it looks at a counterfactual group where there's a percentage changes where we're comparing it to a counterfactual of sort of the same population in the scheme, except people who did not, of course, join our program. You have to opt into our program, so we're not taking care of the full pool. Patients have to willingly join. So I'm going to start on the right here. These numbers probably draw the most attention, easiest for us to all understand here. 140,000 that was able to be saved per patient that enrolled with us, and that amount is taken at the last 3 months of claims in the last 3 months of life. That's how we calculate that. So we look at the two groups. Our patients cost approximately 140,000 rand less. The scheme return was 750% for our two schemes that we started with in 2021. But I don't want to dwell too much on the financials. Those are fantastic, but really, when we're speaking about value, these financial outcomes come from the population health piece that you see over there. The fact that we were able to reduce wasted care. So the 53% less waste is speaking to a reduction in chemotherapy and surgery in the last month of life. So that's 53% less non-beneficial care in the last month of life for our patients. And that alone it changes people's lives. It's very materially impactful for the journeys that our patients go on. We have 79% of deaths at home or in hospice. Now, in the private sector, just across the board, the majority of private patients die in hospital in ICU wards, actually, that most people die. And I think likely, as many of you in this crowd would prefer, many of our patients prefer to die at home, and it's a much better experience when you can die with your loved ones and actually end your life with dignity. So that 79%, I mean, almost alone, that metric, even if we had no savings and nothing else, that's a worthwhile intervention to really bring a lot of value to people's lives. And then our experience of care metric is just a measure of a survey that we do with the next of kins for our deceased patients as to how the overall experience was. We ask them, do you feel like you were emotionally supported? Were the needs understood? Were the needs prioritized appropriately? And would you recommend somebody else to join our program? And that score, again, it's 4 out of 5. I think it was about like 3.9 or something. We'll take the 4. And this is in a space where people are losing their loved ones. So this is that 4 out of 5 is in the context of people losing their loved ones. So really it is, it feels like quite a materially positive score for us to have. So just to iterate, why am I showing this? This is not a sales pitch. This is to showcase what can be done when we focus on value. Some of the outcomes that can be achieved when we are focusing on value. Right. So, there's many other problems to be solved in our healthcare system. some of them really large, you know, maternal health, diabetes, where there's excessive care that feels very avoidable. But there's also smaller problems. It doesn't have to produce such dramatic results to be worthwhile. Okay, so let's speak about what we mean with value. And when we speak about value-based care, it really requires sort of a paradigm shift from the way we currently operate. And apologies, I'm just going to refer back to my little notepad here that I have in case I miss something, just to make sure I cover all the points that I had in my head prior to starting here. Cool. So what I want to say, we need to shift the thought paradigm when we're looking at value. On the left there is typically how markets sort of are constructed in our society, and healthcare is no exception. It's focused on market dominance. That's sort of what gets incentivized and rewarded, and that's a function of competition that is on the basis of size and volume. And it leads to an extractive process where, you know, the more you take, the more you gain. And that perpetuates the status quo of dominance being the leading factor and the sort of the overarching piece. And just to speak to that last piece, it creates a market where control is what typical players are focused on, trying to control the environments that they operate in, leading to an environment filled with mistrust. And basically, it's a zero-sum game where you're trying to take away from someone else to provide for yourself. And we are trying to shift into the thought of into this paradigm of value-based care. And just to say that that left is an extreme case. Of course, that's not directly what happens in all markets, but that's the extreme other end of the spectrum, and we're leaning far more towards that end than we are towards the value spectrum. So it does require a shift in how we think about organizations and markets. And in the value-based care framework, we want to think about market cooperation and competition on the basis of care outcomes. And sorry, just a quick check. You can still hear me when I turn my head, right? It's perfectly fine. Apologies. So competition on the basis of outcomes is the priority. We're paying for the outcomes that we want, paying for the results that we want. That encourages innovation on the supply side, and it leads to more aligned incentives. That is what's going to get you the outcomes that you desire in that structure. So it's about focusing on the outcomes and creating a system that enables that. Now let's drill a little bit down into how we enable value-based care. Cool. So value-based care, all about the outcomes. It's focusing on outcomes that matter to patients and optimizing the cost to achieve those outcomes. The framework that I'm showing here is from Leapfrog to Value. They are an organization that is propelling value-based care in low- and middle-income countries. And the framework states we start by measuring value in terms of costs and outcomes. We need to then deliver value, and delivering value has many facets, from ensuring that we redesign delivery in a way that's patient-centric, to ensuring that we have learning cycles that accommodate improvements, continuous improvements in the care delivery process. And then paying for value. You need to pay for the value in order for it to actually be worthwhile for people to continue providing value. You need to incentivize greater value. Cool. I feel like I'm going to have repeated the word value 2,000 times by the end of this. So we really want to begin with measurement as sort of the crux of value-based care. That's, if you're not measuring the right things, you're on a terrible foundation. So measurement really is the heart of value-based care. So we want to take a pause there and share some of our learnings in terms of designing metrics and measuring value when trying to implement value-based care. And this feels applicable in sort of several realms, predominantly in designing the initiatives, but also when assessing, you know, whether something that you're paying for is doing the right things. You need to also have a good understanding of the metrics that are at use and where they've come from. But some of the key learnings that we've come out with are that you need to work from first principles to really get the best metrics. It can be tempting to look at the data and work with what's available already, but that limits us it's very limiting. You're not going to get the optimal metrics. You're not going to get the optimal measurements if we start in a constrained environment. So let yourself think freely. And in working with first principles, really engaging the providers has been a key part of designing our metrics, getting the people on the ground to contribute throughout that process, that we get metrics that they believe are valuable and that they have bought into being measured against. The buy-in is critical, and that's going to come across again as we dive a little bit further in. And we found that some of the more usual and standard cost metrics, such as just shared savings, do not actually incentivize all the right things. They might be helpful, but they could be harmful in many other senses if you haven't taken out the time to consider all the layers that you really, really care about. I've got a point here about improving data remaining fundamental. The data will ultimately be of critical importance when measuring. So as much as we can say start with first principles, there are going to be some realities that come across. But in that space, you can be creative and use your ingenuity to find new ways to get the data that you need. We've created metrics and sort of developed little surveys that hold us to account and that can really showcase where the value is being presented. Case an example is that 4 out of 5 that I showed you. That's not a difficult survey to put together, but it was needed conscious effort into thinking about what do we want to ask and measure, and then just figuring out a way that makes sense to collect that data for your own initiative. Another critical example that we saw is around, so in the palliative space, a key cost driver is complications sort of after hours, and then patients get rushed to hospitals. So we put in an after hours plan. There's a little fridge magnet that gets put in our patients' homes where there's a plan about what you do after hours, who do you contact in case of an emergency. And we required that our providers put that information on our, on Synapse. It's our, what will I describe it as? It's sort of where our providers engage about patients. It's a supportive tool. I'm describing it terribly, but effectively, that's where we monitor our patients' health. So that measure was something that was not available in the data, but had critical influence on our patient outcomes. So we found a way to measure it and to get that data and make sure that we are keeping abreast of that. And on that, a last point on the data, we found that there's some things that are inherently always going to be useful, some data points that we can work towards so long in anticipation of greater value-based focus. So, for example, death data, that's almost always going to be something that's meaningful when you're trying to understand sort of value that you are producing in your various spaces, and that's not always available. It's not currently in the data structures, and perhaps because it's not in use, but there's sort of some work we can do to think about the data points that we would need and that would generically be useful in a value-based care setting and start building those into our structures now, because we found that it can take a long time to get it right. The death data, for example, that we've been looking for, I think it's been a couple of years in the working, and it's not straightforward. So starting early is helpful. So let's shift into the contracting and value alignment as I try to get my timing. Let's start with this quote by Michael Porter, who's one of the, he's also got a sort of a value-based framework that's quite popular. Many of you might have seen it in previous settings. So he's quoted as saying, we have a lot of misalignment of stakeholders because the incentive structure is still tending to pit one party against another. What we asked ourselves is, requiring patience, what if we could improve quality, save money, and give doctors back their autonomy? What if we could produce a win-win-win situation? And that is what we believe that we have been able to do and what we've been aiming to do. So in our space, what that looked like is improved outcomes for the patients, reduced cost for the schemes, and better reimbursement for the healthcare providers. So all of this was at the forefront of our benefit design and our operational initiatives, is really creating a space where all the parties are winning. And it doesn't necessarily feel obviously intuitive, but we believe that it is possible to create win-win-win situations, and that's the crux of value-based care. So now let's speak to why optimal value requires value alignment. And I'm going to somewhat rush over these points, but we have ensured that we try our best to align the incentives of all our key stakeholders to promote value-based care. The reason that is so critical to think about value alignment is because there is a strong status quo bias that will exist. Let me just take a step back there to say there's several layers that need to be overcome when changing towards value-based care. So you need to overcome all of those barriers to entice the necessary behavioral change and get the outcomes that you want. So here are some of the ones that I want to highlight. So the status quo bias, as I've just mentioned, years and years of doing things in the same way, that's hard to just overcome. There needs to be clear incentive to drive somebody to fight against the status quo. Limited resources and competing priorities. There's always going to be something else that's calling your attention in your worlds. If there isn't an incentive for value, something else might have an incentive that calls you. So it needs to be adequately incentivized to overcome that. There is a risk involved with value-based care. Providers or schemes or anybody else who's holding themselves accountable to value puts, almost by definition, puts some of their revenue or some part of their income model at risk. And that needs to be adequately compensated to overcome the barrier there. And the outcome risk is the shift in processes that is required in value-based care. Again, it sort of somewhat links to the status quo. You have to move away from the way that you've been doing things. You know, providers have been doing things for 20 years, and they know that it works. You're asking for a shift in that process. You need to make sure that they're sufficiently incentivized to take the risk that actually things could go wrong in this venture, because it is an unknown space. For that, at least at an individual level, for an individual provider, it's new territory, and we need to incentivize that. And lastly, human nature. We do react to incentives. We try and perform as best we can across the standards that we're measured against. Against the standards that are prioritized. So now, to speak about this next piece is speaking about how we've aligned incentives, what we've done to enable value-based care in our spaces. There's quite a lot going on in that slide, so I'm going to try to get the pointer to walk us through it. So we found that there's sort of two layers to designing incentives or to getting the outcomes that we want. So there's the technical design of your benefits, of your structures, of your contracts, so that the alignment is there in sort of hard principle. And then there's the sort of qualitative side where you need to ensure that you support the behavior changes needed to get the outcomes that you want. So I want to start with the technical end of it. So in our case, and sort of in all cases really, all the stakeholders carry some level of risk. For our patients, we've covered for the care that leads to optimal value. They carry some layer of risk in that, you know, they're the ones whose outcomes are on the table. Right, they have ultimately the greatest things at risk here. And apologies, there's just one other piece to showcase that all of this is working for the patient. The patient is at the heart of value-based care. It's all about being patient-centered. So we are aligning all other parties' incentives to provide the best experiences for the patients. Our schemes. What we've done is try to design our contracts to incentivize greater uptake from the schemes. So when we started off, we just had a pay for sort of a set fee for each day that providers that a patient was with Aligned. We found that that didn't incentivize the scheme to actually provide the greatest amount of value for their patients, i.e. to encourage more enrollment onto the program. So by designing, so we've thought that through a little bit and sort of fought around various payment structures and have found ourselves at a tiered fee that sort of reduces the price as the numbers go up. And that what that does is it actually incentivizes the scheme to provide value for themselves. Right? So I think a key lesson there is that holding risk can actually be beneficial to an organization. So for the scheme, in this case, it's actually to their benefit to carry that risk so that they're incentivized to provide the value that they ultimately want. Going on to ourselves as Aligned, up in the top right here, we have performance fees that we have designed. So we have a sort of a piece of our fee that is left at risk in accordance to our performance metrics as you've seen them in that first slide. So we hold ourselves to account by making sure that we need to get those, we need to meet certain criteria. The scheme needs to agree that we've met that criteria before we get that bonus piece. Provider side, there's a piece on adequate remuneration for the services that we actually want. So we want to pay providers sufficiently for the things that we want. So in our case, we wanted more home visits for palliative care. So for providers to go see patients in their homes, that requires extra cost to provide that care. The fee for service structure that was available at that stage had a uneconomical or sub-economical price for that consultation. So we had to increase that to actually make it make sense for the providers to go to the patient homes and provide the care that ultimately brings the most value. Global fees to promote teamwork and tiered fees to promote value. These two layers are somewhat in the works still. The global fees really are paying our providers per day that they have a patient under their care, so somewhat of a capitation, and that incentivizes them to work most efficiently with the most efficient resources. So in a fee-for-service environment, a doctor might choose to see the patient themselves every single day and get a consultation fee that's as high as possible each day, despite that being unnecessary. In a global fee structure, you can then pass some of that care on to the nurse or to the social worker where it's appropriate without losing anything from your revenue. Actually, you gain because you're using the more affordable resources. So it encourages the behavior that you want, which is an interdisciplinary system where where the network works together. And our tiered fees are certainly still in the works, and that is really just availing more funds. So tiering our providers according to the value that they've provided in the previous year. So if you were a provider who performed outstandingly, you might be in tier 2. If you performed well, you might be in tier 1 and then in tier 0, and you would be able to charge a different daily fee depending on which category you're at, you're in. And that will, of course, then reinforce that value, or the metrics that we're using to set those tiers are what we care about, and keep that at the forefront of the providers. A question that might be on some people's minds is, where do the savings go in all of this? So we showcased those numbers right at the start. For us, the savings go straight back to the schemes and effectively back to the patients. So we are not in a shared savings model of any form, and we don't think that's necessarily the best approach to share the savings. It might throw off the balance in your alignment of incentives. So we have a piece of our fee that gets boosted if we meet our criteria. So that's in part where the savings go. If we haven't provided sufficient savings, we wouldn't have met the criteria to get the higher fee. And similarly, in the case for our providers, some of that savings goes back to them in the form of higher fees if they reach the different thresholds. But ultimately, the balance, once those thresholds have been reached, the balance goes back into the hands of the scheme and back into the patient's hands and back into the system to hopefully provide more value elsewhere. The next is supporting the changes in behavior, supporting the changes in behavior that we want to actually see also requires our focus and attention. We can't just leave it at aligning the incentives as we've outlined above. There's a lot of complexity to overcome. So here we're just showcasing some of the learnings around that. So for our patients, we've had to educate them, empower them, and build trust in a system that where they had lost a lot of that trust, so that they actually know that they have this service available, they have palliative care as an option, and they don't default to, say, what one of their providers might recommend chemo when they are in that last month of life. So educating them that you have other options, that so that enables the shift in behavior and the shift in care delivery that we want. Similarly, in the scheme discussions, so shifting into these contracts is can be sort of, it's a different realm for many schemes. It's a new territory. So there's a piece that needs to support them in shifting into value-based contracting. So in part of that was the reframing risk, as I mentioned briefly earlier. Reframing risk, she say, actually sometimes risk is a good thing to hold on to some of that risk. Making use of pilots, being willing to test out products and gain that evidence alongside the scheme. We have and designing benefit options that support value. For our case, we are working in palliative oncology, and effectively, at some point, you stop treatment and you move into palliative care, but there's a strong overlap where you're in both. And when designing this benefit, we found it very critical to ensure that the palliative piece of it is not does not affect the oncology. So if it took away from the oncology benefit, would have had a lot more resistance with all the oncologists that we've worked with in terms of getting somebody out of curative care and having to push them into palliative care. So it forces sort of a choosing one or the other, which isn't necessarily beneficial. In our case, having them both available at the same time is what actually produces the best outcomes. And it's conscious. It's a conscious design that enables that. Another piece of behavioral change, so in our space, is timing our metric calculations to keep value in mind. So our metrics are typically done on annual basis. We found that being forced to see that value quarterly and assess it quarterly helps keep it top of mind a little bit better. So a factor like timing can actually have a material impact on the behavior that you get from your partners. And on the provider side, certainly easing the administrative burden of changing behavior has been critical, making it as seamless as possible in various forms. We wanted more interdisciplinary care, so we provided a platform where they all share a patient thread and all see the same information about the patient at the same time to enable that. So sort of just working within their realities and seeing where can you support the delivery of the outcomes that you want. Engaging with grace and trust was also a key piece of our success with our provider network, and that we really trusted that they had the best intentions for the patients when engaging with them. We've gone in, we've had very meaningful conversations with them about the way to design this in a way that's optimal. And I think the system had sort of, as I outlined in that paradigm shift slide, it's somewhat pitted providers and schemes in different boxes. So coming into that engagement with really an open mindset and making sure that they feel that we're on the same team was quite important in getting the buy-in necessary and getting the buy-in for the overall project, and then also getting the behavioral changes that we needed. Okay, I'm now going to speed through the last bit. I see the eyes from Charlton. So some lessons from structuring contracts is that we need to create and align incentives for the key stakeholders. Of course, that's really, I think that came across from the get-go and in other talks. Unsuitably strong incentives for one metric can deter the pursuit of others. So in this case, that could be the shared savings model, where if it's too strong an incentive, you might sacrifice quality to get more of those savings and more of those savings. So then there is a balance that's necessary. Choosing the appropriate time frames for measuring value, as we spoke about now. It's really important not to ignore the qualitative considerations. So how you go about doing things makes a meaningful difference in the outcomes that you get. So when assessing a value intervention, we need to also think about the manner in which it's been applied. Avoid designs that pit one party against each other, and be willing to iterate as you learn. So value-based care really is sort of all about getting more and more value. And as we start, we're not going to get all of the value, certainly not in the first year of operation. Possibly not ever will you be able to capture all of the value. All you want to do is make sure that you're improving as you go along and willing to learn along the way. Our closing remarks. Well, we need to shift into a new thought paradigm, as you said, to be able to really focus where we all focus on value together, and we are cooperative, and we ensure that our values are in line, that we are all aligned in incentive to produce the most value and the best outcomes for patients. The right metrics are at the heart of value-based care, so we need to take care in designing those metrics. It's really fundamental that we don't rush through that process. Good data is essential for measurement. Apologies, I'm still on that slide, sorry. Good data is essential for measurement. We need the data to work with us. We need the data to be able to actually measure. But within that, we can be creative about how we get data. So we're not confined to what is currently out there. Focus on aligning incentive as opposed to avoiding risk. So think about how you can make sure that you and the other party and every party involved are incentivized to produce the outcomes that you want, even if it means taking on additional risk. Behavior change, even with the right incentives, is not easy. So there's more to getting the change in behavior than designing incentive structures. You do need to think about the actual execution. Be open to continuous learning and improvement in pursuit of value, as I've just shared. And be creative, be courageous, and be cooperative in this pursuit of value-based care. Really, that is what I wanted to share with you all today. I hope that some of these learnings have been valuable to you. Seeing some of this hopefully will, perhaps spark a deeper interest in value-based care, and you can all take it forward in stride as you go along your careers. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mufaro. The moment you said, "I am not marketing," it scared me a little bit because I thought, here we go. But certainly you have shared quite a lot around how to. And I think your last points, they are not very actuarial, like being able to listen to other guys, working in the team, being able to be creative. But I'm sure we'll get there. Right. So thank you for also managing the time very well. We'll go into questions. And as always, we start with the online questions. Barry is asking, when you are measuring savings and outcomes, how do you allow for the selection effect of both doctors and patients who may be predisposed to palliative care, so they would anyway save money and have better outcomes? That's a very actuarial question.
That is a very actuarial question. I have to start by caveating it that I'm not an actuary. I think that's a really great point. I'm not sure that it's been fully accounted for in that balance, but we do our risk adjustments. Our actuarial team risk adjusts and does sort of several technical pieces that I'm not fully privy to. So I can't answer that question well. I think that's a good consideration that I don't have top of mind. So worth revisiting. As I mentioned, we have one of my colleagues here, so I'm not sure she has anything to add, but that is the best answer I can give you for now, Barry, but perhaps we can give you something on email.
So let's hope there is certainly some risk adjustment there. But also, I think while the question is quite valuable, I think for me one of the biggest takeaways has been the value aspect out of it. We can debate about the exact amounts of savings, but I think the quality outcomes are quite important and worthwhile. Any questions from the floor?
So I think mine is just it's more a comment than a question. The value lies in the benefit actually being available. So when I was working with my research into end-of-life care, what I found was it wasn't a lot of specific palliative care benefits. So providers offer what is covered. So just having this aligned benefit available means that there's more people that get educated about it, more people that get the opportunity to offer it, and more people get exposed to good palliative care near the end of life. So yeah, thank you very much, Mufara.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah.
Thank you so much for the comment. So, at least you have help. My question is, you seem to have done quite well in terms of the palliative care, and your model is quite useful and structured in terms of how you approach it. making sure that you don't step on toes as you do the behavioral change. So my question is, what next? Palliative care is one. Which other place are we going to go to?
Is that a real question? Okay, just checking. You had a smirk that looked like maybe it was one of those, ha ha ha, I caught you. No, we are, I guess we're looking at various different options at this stage. Currently, we're reinforcing our palliative product and making sure that it's working optimally. It's been a 1 year, so there were a lot of kinks, a lot of things that, you know, didn't go as perfectly as we would like, and we are getting those tidied up while keeping our eyes open. So I mentioned one, maternal health as sort of a potential place to look into, but really it's keeping our eyes open to areas that are ripe for value. We want to start with the places that have a lot of expenditure that can be avoided. Because, yeah, you wanna start with the big wins. Okay. I think Lungi would like to add to that.
So there are some things about the complex problems that lend themselves to value-based care kind of solutions. So, for example, as Peter said, whether design actually enables poor value is one of the places you have to look to start, because the way we deliver healthcare in and of itself drives incorrect behavior. So where we know that the kind of a problem is one where the design of the system itself inherently drives poor value is one of the first areas that we look at. Then we look at areas where you require a multidisciplinary team to deliver the outcome. Where there are solo models, it's so much harder to actually create the value. Most of the value is unlocked in setting up multidisciplinary teams. And what often takes long is exactly that piece, getting the multidisciplinary team to work well, because you're actually changing the way the system is designed. And then the other piece is the benefit design piece. We have to get that right. And so some of the problems that we're looking at are those kinds of problems. Maternal health makes sense. I mean, we can rattle through a zillion of them. And you have to be able to actually sequester it nicely to be able to do it. So mental health, oncology, I mean, there are many. Okay.
Thank you for being with us today. I certainly get the idea that you guys are used to working in a multi-skilled environment. So thank you so much. I think for me, your presentation and the work you're doing is quite exciting in that you're able to bring a lot of skills together and you are open to the idea of solving challenging problems. So I can see why they call you the problem solver.